I'm here with John Acuff today, and he is a New York Times bestselling author of several books. It's Quitter, Start, Do-Over, and I think the most recent one is Finish.
That's right.
Yeah, and I like all of the short-term names. I don't like the ones that are two sentences long.
Well, nobody says that name. I had a book that was long. It was a long title, and even I had a book that had three words, and people don't say the right three words. Or with Start, they say, "I love your book, punch fear in the face," because they say what they remember. So you title your book, but you ultimately know it's like a song lyric. I had somebody the other day go, "I love your book. I give out so many copies," and then they told me a book I hadn't written. And you're like, you don't want to correct them, but it was actually a book I hate. And so I was kind of like, that is a terrible book. I hate that book. It's such a dumb book. And but you, I don't know what you're supposed to do in that moment. I just said, thank you. I appreciate the compliment.
Right. You just
it's one of my worst books.
I will
books.
Take that. Yeah. I can't give Sorry. That back to
yeah.
you. So how did you even get to writing books? I mean, that's not really necessarily your background, right? I mean, how did you even get to that point?
No, I mean, I was in marketing. I loved advertising and the power of marketing to get people, to help people change something they believe or change what they're doing with just an idea. Like, it feels like alchemy to me. And so I was in marketing, and then the internet kind of happened. I had my first kind of blog in 2001 with a buddy named Billy, and it was so hard because you had to build them in Dreamweaver. And it was just so clunky.
I know Frontpage.
Yeah, it was just, and so and we had more merch than we had content. I immediately ordered stickers and t-shirts. Like, I can give you a Sweet Raymond sticker if you need 1,000 right now from my garage.
No, I need 1,100, so you're not going to be able to.
Well, I won't be able to fulfill that. Yeah, so I did that. And then in 2008, started another blog that kind of gained some momentum. And from there started to say, like, well, why don't I turn this blog into a book? Because that seemed like a thing. And then from there, like, once you've done it once, you're like, oh, okay, like, it's not impossible. Like, before you do it, it's probably like starting a company. Like, before you start a company, you're like, this is impossible and superhumans do it and I don't know how to do it. And then, like, 3 years in, you're like, oh, wait, I'm at dinner parties and people go, what do you do? And you're like, oh, I'm my own company. And you're like, all of a sudden you're saying it. And then you might start a second or a third.
But it's interesting that you said it's not impossible, because I think that starting a company and writing a book, all these different things that seem like really large projects, mm-hmm. people can't quite start them, let alone finish them, which happens to be a good segue into your latest book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think for me, though, like, I think the hard part is being willing to do stuff that sucks for a long time. Like, that doesn't feel good. Like, writing a new book, I don't care if you've written 10 or 20, unless you're like a systems guy where it's like you and 17 other people writing your books and it's a formula and like, the main guy has a name like, I don't know, like Croc McGinnis, you know, and they're just formulaic. But I think even writing a new book for me is like, oh, I got to go sit in these bad ideas and be willing to show up for them in the hope that a good idea also shows up in that. Like, I cast this huge net. That's the hard part to me, is being willing to do something that doesn't feel good, because that's the process. Nobody writes to draft. Like first draft is the final draft. And, like, that's one of the hard parts to me.
So, in the, I think closer to the beginning of your book, you talk about the idea around chronic starters.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I would say up until, I would say the last company I had, would have considered myself a chronic starter.
Mm-hmm.
And where I would have multiple things going on at one time, and I never was able to quite see it all the way through or finish what I was at, the goals I had, the thing I was trying to achieve. And so the result of that was I never succeeded at any of those
sure.
things. Kind of go into that a little more as far as the, what can people do who suffer from the same thing that I suffered from early on and still do a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think part of it is you get some community. Like, you need other people. It's not a bad thing to need other people to help kind of drag you across the finish line. Like, I think sometimes we think, oh, it's just gonna be me. For it to count, it has to be my thing and only me, and versus going to a buddy, like, hey, I'm never going to do this. Like, I've said I'm going to do it for 10 years. I'm never going to do it. Like, I need you to drag it. You know, sometimes you need to set up consequences for yourself that make it painful if you don't. So for me, for 10 years, I told people, I'm going to do comedy. Someday I'm going to do comedy. I'm going to do comedy. And I didn't. And then I went and saw a comedian, and I didn't think his opener was good. And I thought, oh, if that's comedy, like, I can do that. And so I texted my assistant and said, find the best venue in Nashville. And it was Zany's, which is our own, like, really our biggest and only comedy club in Nashville. And so then I announced it. Like, so now there's all this, like, if I don't do it, there's a lot of people that are like, they've purchased tickets. Like, their question of whether or not I was going to write a 60-minute comedy set was no longer a question. It was just I had to do it. It didn't make it easy, but, like, it eliminated my ability to go, someday I'll do comedy. Like, all of a sudden, there are all these things. And I think the other thing you have to admit is that I think the fear side of it, and I think there's a million fears that make you not finish, but one of them that I'm kind of coming to grips with is the fear of, what if I fully invest and it's the wrong thing? And I think we're afraid we're going to look up and we're going to be 2 years down a process and realize, I just wasted these 2 years. And so instead, what we'll do is go, I'll start 12 things that I invest a month in. And so then, like, hopefully I can never have regret. Like, I'll never be able to, but I'll never get the joy of this and the satisfaction of doing it. But it's this weird protection mechanism. And so I think the ability to say, no, I'm going to do this thing for X period of time, and I'm going to focus, and I'm going to ignore other stuff. And I might even be angry about it. Like, when I'm finishing, like, it's not like, ah, this is amazing. Sometimes it's like, I hate this, but I want it done. And I want to finish it, and I want to cross it off the list, and I want to... And so, like, I think it's this huge emotional thing, too. Like, that's part of the challenge to me. But I think you get friends, you get consequences, you make sure you actually care about it. I think a lot of people start things they shouldn't start, like, and start companies that, even if it succeeded, they'd hate that. Like, I'm coming to grips with the fact, I don't want a 30-person company. I'd be terrible at that. I would hate to manage 30 people.
I had a 30-person company, yeah. And I hated it.
Yeah, I would.
It's not me. I mean,
but it's not who I am, but our culture goes, you need to scale. Like, one of the things that I'm really passionate about, and I hate this, is people that say to me, you're leaving money on the table. Like, you're leaving money, like, it could be bigger, leaving money on the table. That's such a terrible thing to say to a person, because it'd be like, we live in the same neighborhood. If we are at the pool and we talk to somebody who is an accountant, and I said to them, what was your salary last year? I said, never mind, don't tell me that. It wasn't enough. That's how I feel about you. It wasn't enough. That's what you're saying to other entrepreneurs. It could be bigger. You could sell more. You should scale. You're saying to them, I believe you're a failure. With very little information about your life, I think you should make more money. You would never say that to somebody at a dinner party that had a traditional job. I don't know why entrepreneurs do that to each other.
Okay. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and that was about the comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as an aside... I was there. It was awesome. I think every local comedian in Nashville hates you, because nobody should ever be able to go out and not only talk for an hour, mm-hmm. you know, but be actually funny. And you know, I'm not saying it just to say
no,
it.
No, you wouldn't bring it up.
It was funny.
It's so funny it you said it. Let me add something.
And that's actually not the point I want to make, but let's go with that for a second.
No, so what you just said is funny to me, because yesterday I talked to a friend. And they live in another country. They're missionaries now. And they wrote this great update letter. And a responder was like, that was really well written. I love that. And I was talking to him about it. He said, yeah, my wife said, I know John was just being nice, but I appreciate that. And I said to him, no, but you know I'm not nice like that. I wouldn't have said that as a nicety.
Right.
I only said it because I meant it. Like, I'm not a nice person that way. And he goes, that's so funny. I told her that. And it's the same. Like, you wouldn't have brought up the comedy. Like, we would have talked about a million other topics.
I would have stayed silent.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as I'm being smart about it, I would have not said a thing.
So funny.
Sometimes I'm not.
But I cut you off on your point, which we're going to do
today. No, it's, so you brought up that for years you've wanted to do that, and you kept putting it off. And then what you did was you put it out there. You put it out there in front of everybody. It's kind of like exposing yourself.
Yeah.
But you talk about and finish about the idea around shame and how you should deal with that. Can you, I mean, so for somebody who is listening right now and they're like, yeah, I've done it before and I didn't follow through and I felt a lot of shame, or the way I went about it did not work out for me. How would you suggest they approach that the next time around?
I think so much of it is, how are you personally motivated? Like, how does, And I think that's why there's a lot of bad advice online where people go, this is how you build a company. And it, what they're really saying is, this is how I built my particular company in my particular set of circumstances in my particular city. And then we go, well, that's how you do it. And then we try to replicate it and we hate how it feels. And so when somebody feels shame, a lot of that is, that's based off of their personal definition of shame. Like, I know I need an audience. Like, I need an audience. I like an audience. I do better with an audience. So sharing it gave me an audience. For some people, if you hate an audience, that pressure is going to cripple you. Like, that's going to, you know, I went
That's not the right path.
It's not the right path. It's not the right tip. It's not the right trick. It's not the right tool. I think you just have to, like, you learn to eventually start to be honest with what things cause you shame and then go, okay, is that a thing that I can fix or is it a thing I need to admit and own and move on? So, like, I'm, you know, I feel shame that I'm not, like, an amazing leader, that I don't lead 100 people. And my wife is like, but if the word was banker, you wouldn't feel like you should be a banker. It's just because our culture says the pathway is individual, owner, leader, like, you're a leader. And if I'm not wired for that, I feel ashamed of that. And so then I end up saying yes to things I shouldn't say yes to because I think that's what you're supposed to do. And then I feel more shame and it becomes a circle. And so the key for me there is to go, this is who I am. This is what I'm good at. These are the things that I hate and they make me feel terrible. I should do less of those things. I'm going to shape my life this way. Like, that's even like with comedy, I know I'm not going to do that. Like, to be the
although
kind
I think
of,
you, although I think you should.
Yeah, but to be the kind of comedian I'd need to be, I would have to do it 200 nights a year. Like, to get to the level I would desire.
You have no family life. You'd have
and
no
I
ha- life.
And I'm not like, and that's not a criticism to anybody who does comedy really well, because I think it's an amazing, like, my respect went through the roof with how they do what they do. But I just know I would, there's no way I'd be able to get off the train. Like, I would, the adrenaline was like nothing I've ever experienced. Like, I was spinning for
no,
days.
No, you're on point, man. You were just, it was like a meant to be type thing. But I knew that you get that out of your system because you speak a lot. And
well, but it's so different. Like, so yeah, I mean, I guess I'm really curious about shame. I think I keep going back to relationship. I had coffee with a friend the other day and I was just like, I was such a jerk this week. And he was like, I've been a jerk for like 3 weeks. And like, we talked about like our wives and like what was going on. And even to have somebody you can say to, like, I was a huge jerk. And not only was a jerk, I fake apologized by blaming my jerkiness on something that wasn't the cause. And I knew it wasn't the cause. Like, I said, like, oh, I felt like this person wasn't getting enough attention. I didn't care about that. It was about me not getting enough attention. And so, like, to have another human that you can say, yeah, I'm pretty broken. And they go, oh, so am I. Like, we're a mess. And I still like you. And we're still going to get coffee. I think that's one of those. I think shame is meant to be carried, not individually.
Okay. So let's look at in the way that fits you best. You have sort of put that thing, that goal that you want to do out there, and, you know, and it might be in the way you did it, it might be in a way that fits, you know, myself better. What typically happens, and this again is kind of the story of my life, is I bite off more than I can chew with what my goals are.
Sure.
And so one of the things that really resonated with me in Finnish was you talking about cutting those goals in half.
Yeah, that was one of, there's a handful of counterintuitive things that the research showed. I mean, this was the first book I've done where it just wasn't based off my ideas. I actually partnered with a PhD named Mike Peasley, and we studied nearly 900 people for 6 months. And this was one that, it's funny, if I'm not careful, if I send this idea to a client without telling them about it first, they automatically go, no. We want our sales team to sell quadruple. Like, that's a terrible right, idea. Right. And I go, wait, let me explain it. So the research we saw was that over and over people go, especially in America, we have this like, go big or go home. Or like, we say things like, if your dream doesn't scare you, it's not big enough. And he feels so good, like on a CrossFit ad or like on a unicorn, you know, like on Instagram with swirly font. And then what happens though is if you try to lose 10 pounds and you only lose 8, you don't feel like you almost got there. You feel like you missed it by two and you give up. And so what we wanted to test was, what if you change it to five? Like, just go along with us. I know it feels lazy, whatever. What if you change it to five? You lose the same 8 pounds, same exact weight. You feel like you won by three. And the crazy thing is, you try again. Like, that's what I'm about, is like, how do I get you to try more than a month or try more than a week? Like, I always tell businesses, I care more about your second quarter than I do your first. And I care more about your third than I do your second. And so people that cut it in half were 63% more successful. Now, that takes crazy, it's funny, it takes crazy courage to do it, because it feels counterintuitive and lazy, and shame will get loud and go like, other leaders would be doing triple this. Other leaders say, sleep when you're dead. Like, you should be doing. But the older I get and the more comfortable I get in my own skin, the more I'm able to go, that thing I think is going to take me an hour will actually take me three. And that's not failure. And then I do the three, and like, it's good. And I don't hate myself during it. And I don't hate the client because I've tried to force it too fast. And that's where I'm trying to live.
I have this life philosophy that I've adopted in almost everything I take. And it's called the philosophy of lowered expectations. And it sounds really cynical and it sounds really bad, but I am, since I truly started kind of in, you know, living that way, I'm happier. Like, I'm happier, as in, I think that we live in a society and a culture where we feel very entitled. We have high expectations of everybody around us. Mm-hmm. And I've found that when I kind of lower my expectations, don't expect everything to be perfect every time, that I'm ecstatic when it actually hits the expectations of other people that they normally have for the same thing.
Yeah, but I think the challenge, I mean, like, the reality there too is, it's not lowered as in negative expectations.
It's not negative.
It's not cynical. It's like, so, I mean, a lowered expectation, again, could be, the thing that I would estimate takes me an hour, if I'm realistic, it usually takes me three, and that's okay. I'm not going to feel guilty from hour two to three, like, I should have done this faster, or the client shouldn't make me do this, or, you know, like, you go, like, my expectation was three, and I did it in 2.5. Awesome. Like, I beat it. Like, it's just a mindset thing.
Well, I'm thinking along the lines of, you know, as far as, like, entrepreneurism and realism. And
those aren't words that usually go together.
Of course not. Oh yeah, I mean, I'm a true entrepreneur, which I include myself in, is like a, you know, endless amounts of hope. even when everybody else is like, that ain't gonna work.
Yeah,
they're like, oh, it'll work.
I think you have to set the context. Like, you talk about expectations, but I think you have to set the context. And I haven't written about this idea because I haven't figured out how to frame it yet. But I always think about, like, meeting an exchange student in high school, like, from Germany, and thinking, like, that dude has terrible shoes. Like, what a weird shoes he has. But in Germany, like, those are the coolest shoes ever. So, like, I'm only seeing him out of his context. So the problem is when, like, say you lose 10 pounds and your goal is 100. Like, you lost 10 pounds. That's your whole context. Versus saying, okay, you know, I didn't lose 200 instantly. Like, you get to set the context, and you get to say, okay, here's what an expectation is. Here's what counts. Here's what, I think the doesn't count versus what counts is a huge part of this.
I think what I was thinking about was this idea that I've gone to, say, a conference, or I've read these books, or, you know, just saw the speaker, and now I'm pumped and I'm going to go start my thing. And I set my goals that I'm going to have 1,000 customers, and it's going to be this and that, whatever. And it's not realistic.
Yeah.
I mean, so I know you've been kind of talking about this, but what would your advice be around that? And in fact, and I'll even throw something out there, because again, a lot of these things that you wrote about and finished remind me about what we're talking about, and that's data.
Yeah.
To actually, instead of making goals based on feelings and what you want, you
or
actually make
the
them
conference.
Based on data.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that comes back to the question, based on what? Like, if you ask yourself, based on what? I mean, I'm, you know, when I launch courses online, like, I'm working on a course for public speakers because I love public speaking. I'm a geek about it. I think that everyone has to be a public speaker. Like, if you've negotiated a salary raise, you've done the hardest speech known to man. But I know that my expectations initially will be when we launch it, we'll have like 40% of the list will love it. Like, no, they won't. Like, if I look at the data will tell me like, hey, here's the truth. Like, the line I use in Finnish is data kills denial, which prevents disaster. So there's launches where I go, I think we're going to convert 15%. And my buddy Brian, who helps me, will go, okay, I'm not being negative. I'm not trying to be a jerk. Our last 7 launches have averaged 4%. Can you explain to me where you think we'll have quadruple the results? And then I go, because I'm eye of the tiger. You know, like, it's emotional. It's not based in data. And data helps me go, okay, well, maybe that's not the right expectation. And I think part of it is the challenge. It's kind of like writing a book. When you write a book, you have to write it with a full heart and then edit it with a cold heart. So your full heart is full of hope and all these ideas are amazing. And then like your cold heart is like, you're cutting. So dream your initial thing with a full heart as an entrepreneur, but then you have to be willing to divorce and cut off stuff that is no longer the thing or isn't realistic or the market shifted and they no longer want that. I mean, I think about that, like the comedy routine you saw, I did probably 3 minutes on Florida. I initially had like 11, but I was practicing it in Austin to a live audience. And in the middle of it, I thought, this is boring to me. It's got to be boring to them. And so I had to go like, I thought this idea was really funny. It's not. So I have to cut it. It doesn't mean you're negative. It means you go, the number of laughs I'm getting from this material is dramatically different than I hoped for. In my office by myself, I hoped for like every joke was a standing ovation. I'd be like, please, please, folks, sit down. This is going to take all night with all this clapping. Like, so I think that's the dance, is between like wild optimism, but also not criticizing realism. And I think we say that to each other. We go like, your realism should never enter your vocabulary if you're a dreamer, if you're an entrepreneur. And I think, well, like, enjoy your business that exists for like an hour and a half. Like,
right,
good
right.
luck.
Exactly. So I was poke around on your site, acuff.me.
Yeah.
And there's this calendar.
Yeah.
what's the deal with this calendar? This giant calendar.
I love that calendar so much. So 8 years ago, I kind of realized that if I can't see time, it's fictional. Like, if I can't actually see it, it doesn't exist. Like, somebody go, what's your August like? And I go, probably hot. Like, I had no sense of what was coming, when it was coming. And so to the data point, I decided, okay, I'm going to start being deliberate about looking at my year, looking at my month, looking at my week. And there was this huge wall calendar this guy, Jesse Phillips, designed. And it's like 3.5 by 2. And I mount it on foam core and I bring it to meetings. Like, it's like a paddleboard and I love it. And like, I know what's going on. And the best part is I put the next year on back of the last year. And so when somebody goes, what did we do last year for that launch? I don't have to go, I don't know. I flip it and go, this is what we did. And so I started to kind of, and I'm not an organized guy. I'm very disorganized. But it gave me this sense of peace to know, okay, I have these 2 trips. So the stuff I'm going to plan around that. Or like if you looked at the calendar I have in my office right now, I know there's 14 days with a big W on them between now and the end of the year. And that means I'm home, I'm writing, I'm going to be at this coffee shop for this chunk of hours. I put it on my Google Calendar. And so the act of doing that brings me such clarity in kind of a chaotic entrepreneurial world.
So that's what I was wondering was, I prefer to have as much digital as possible, but I got the impression that there is something really helpful and significant in having this be physical and tangible and something that you see outside the screen.
Well, and not only I see it, but my family sees it. So it becomes this like, there's, you know, like we know, okay, here's where dad is. Like, here's what, you know, and because that's part of being an entrepreneur when you have a family. Like, it's different if you're 27 and it's just you and like you have different commitments then. So like, I love that. I love that, you know, some people like the dry erase one because a lot of being an entrepreneur isn't lived in ink, you know. I mean, I think people probably say to both of us, like, what's an average day look like? And you're like, well, it's never the same every day. Like, today was different than yesterday. And so, no, I find it, and it's the act of doing it. And I like that it almost becomes like a monument because I have 7 of those in my office. And I can go, if I'm curious about like, man,
7,
am I doing, not 7 of this year, 7 of the last year.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm really deliberate about going, am I traveling more or less? Am I writing more or less? Like I can go,
interesting.
Wow, I wrote, you know, and I can measure, like, mid-year I counted, and because people go, oh, you're gone all the time. I was gone 24 nights for business and 26 nights for vacation with my family. So I can say, okay, I feel good about that. Like, I'm deliberate about that. And it forces me as a dad to be deliberate about it, because parenting, like, entrepreneurs are the worst at this. They're super specific about, like, meetings and all these calls, but then they kind of hope parenting will happen organically and, like, just kind of fit in. And so I have to plan that stuff, or I won't naturally gravitate to being, like, a good dad.
Yeah, I would say that we didn't have kids during the first 10 years of my true kind of real hardcore entrepreneurial time. I don't know how I could have been a good father during that time. I mean, I didn't get
to sleep. Yeah, but see, we don't like to talk about that you can't have everything. Like, that's not a popular topic. Like, we feel like, I think it's hilarious the stuff we do where, like, we're trying to measure everything, and we're like, oh, I can be it. Like, my kid knows I love him, even though, like, there's something about actually putting in the time. And I think you can have a lot of things. I don't think you can have everything.
Yeah, it's interesting because people I look up to from a, wow, look what they help make. Mm-hmm. I would never want to swap my life with them. And so what I'm thinking of is...
And you don't often know what their life is like. Like, that's the... So, like, an example that I sometimes do, and I like this guy. We did an event together. He was super nice. When people compare their life to Gary Vee, like, mm-hmm. or what he does, or what he's able to accomplish, because they're like, that dude is everywhere. He's on, like, he's crushing stuff. He has 600 people that work for him, but they never take that into account. So it's such an unfair comparison. And I always say, like, if you drove past a building with 600 people in it, you wouldn't go, I'm not competing as well as that building. That building is beating me right now. I should be doing as much as that building. You'd go, there's 600 people in there. I'm like one entrepreneur. But when it's a personality online, you forget the machine behind it. And you go, like, how is he getting videos out so fast? Like, how is he? Because he has a camera crew. Like, he has talented people. And it's not a fair comparison.
I think of people like Elon Musk, where he talks about how, you know, he's doing everything all at the same time, and he talks about how he's at the plant and sleeping there or whatever, and then you find out that he also has kids. Mm-hmm. And then as a parent, I'm kind of like, okay, I think you're doing a lot of really neat things.
Yeah.
But is that kid fatherless? You know what I mean? I have no idea. I mean, he may spend a lot of time with his kid. I have no idea what the facts are around it. Just like we were talking about with Gary. I mean, like, he has an entire team. It's not what it looks like.
Yeah.
But I think other people kind of see that, and they think they have to be that way in order to be successful or to do something.
Yeah. I think a huge part of that is figuring out what your version of success is, you know, and saying, okay, like, and that gets back to the leaving money on the table. Like, why can't that be deliberate? Why can't, you know... Could I make twice as much money next year by doing three times as many speaking engagements? Yeah, maybe, but I know I have 45 Fridays left with Ellie in the fall until she graduates. 45. So that's 15 a year for the next 3 years. Like, God help me if I run my business so poorly that my business falls apart because I block off 15 football games. Like, if that's how thin we are, like, I'll sell cars. Like, I'll walk places before I go, like, I'm sorry. Like, cause I don't, and it sounds cheesy, but like, I can earn more money in 3 years. I can't buy back those Fridays.
Right.
So.
No, it's true. I mean, I think back on when my kids were younger and I was having to put in much more time into my old business. And I'm like, man, I missed that. I had to travel for this. Yeah. And you can't.
But part of that, like, part of it is, we're talking parenting to a degree, but like, when people say childhood is fast, it is, but it's also not. 0 to 5 is slow. You should never tell somebody with an 18-month-old, like, childhood is fast. No, it's not. Like, today has felt 42 hours long. It's like being in a casino. Like, I don't know what time it is, but then it starts speeding up from 6 to 12, and then like 13 to 18 is a blur because they have their own friends, their own stuff. Like, they're not hanging on you to be like, what are we doing today? They're like, oh, by the way, so-and-so asked me to do this, and I'm going to do it, you know, and you want that. Like, that's positive. Like, you want your son to be around the neighborhood on his bike with friends. Like, you want that for him, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so let's talk John Acuff marketing. Because sure. Because the reality for you is that, as much as I'm not really sure how much I like this kind of label, you are your personal brand. I mean, you are a personal brand. Mm-hmm. You're not a brand like Coy Wolf.
Yep.
You are John Acuff, and you can't avoid it because what you've chosen to do, which is speaking and writing and a little bit of comedy here and there, it has you and your name and your face all over it. And so what that means is, at least in this day and age, is that you need people to have an affinity towards you. You need to be able to connect with people. You need to, in this world, be on social. And so I'm really curious to know sort of how you approach that. I mean, how do you balance that? What's the real John Acuff and what isn't? And I'm sure that all of it's the real John Acuff, but I'm saying, like, how do you balance between what you think politically, what you think religiously, whatever it might be, and of course not go to a place that might isolate people who might want to buy your stuff or hear from you? I mean, how do you balance all that?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things is I treat it like a job. So, like, sometime, I mean, a long time ago, people might go, I wish you, you know, why don't you talk about politics on Twitter? And to that, I would say, well, did you email your whole office on interoffice email and tell them what you thought about politics? Because if you did that, then by all means, let me tweet something. Like, it's not my personal account. It's a business account. Like, it is tied to, you know, I hopefully will be the kind of person that has a different conversation with a friend over coffee than I would on Twitter, because those are different mediums and there's a different relationship.
What do you do with those urges, though? I mean, surely, because
if it's late at night, I tweet it and the next day I delete it.
That's exactly what I do.
Yeah.
I mean,
and then I get up and feel terrible, and then
I just missed it.
Yeah. There's a handful of, I mean, case in point, somebody was super mean about me doing the comedy thing. A local comedian was like,
I knew they hated you. They hated you because you were so funny.
I hope you bomb. You're like, how dare you skip the line? Like, as if the last 10 years, like, I wanted, and so, like, I responded once and I shouldn't have responded. Like, my response was bad. But then, like, he was really like, I hope you fail. Like, I really hope you do. And I've never had somebody that aggressively being like, who doesn't know me? Like, I'm sure there are people who know me that might go, John's, you know, this or John's that. But, like, we had no interaction. So I try to not engage with it. I'm trying to approach it more like Seth Godin. Like, Seth Godin isn't on Twitter because he knows it wouldn't be good for him. Seth Godin says he doesn't read his reviews on Amazon. Like, I love that he goes, that's a boundary I need to set because I don't want to get lost in that. Like, and he's brilliant. It's not, that's not an act of weakness. That's an act of intelligence. Like, I love that. I really admire that he sets that boundary. And so I try to not see it. And I try to remember that, like, the doorway to social media is the belief that other strangers need to know my opinion. Like, when you know that that's the beginning of people, you start to go, but there are stuffs that, like, there's certain things that if you saw me, you'd go, oh, you have a really thick skin. And there's other things that, like, that's the thing.
I think we're all like that.
Right away, I am like, what? And then, I celebrate every time I don't respond. Like, I go, oh, look at that. Like, I start to write. I'm like, I don't need to do this right now, because what's going to happen is I'm going to send it out, and then I'm going to have to check on it, and then I'm going to enter into this dark tunnel, like, where I spend time, and then I'm going to go look at their life so I can really judge them. Like, what have they accomplished? You know, like...
Okay, so you, and this is, it should be an easy decision. It's just hard because of just how we're wired. But so we've established that you don't go there. When you do, you realize it pretty quickly and delete it. But one of the other things you said was that, yeah, you know what? It is a personal brand. I mean, you kind of agree with me on that. And my social presence is my business, right?
Yeah.
So how... Like, what goes through your mind? What's the purpose of sharing so many intimate, in a sense, details or events in your life? And, you know, you share with your family and your kids and whatever. What, in other words, when I see that, I mean, I see that as just you showing the good parts of your life, mm-hmm. which extends beyond personal brand. And it extends beyond the fact that the account is just simply your business account. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, like, part of it is it's just fun. Like, I like to write funny things, and it's a platform for me to tell a joke to 100,000 people. Like, that's fun. I enjoy that. I do that. I would say the opposite. Like, I would, if you pulled up my Instagram account right now, I guarantee, like, there's probably one business post in the last 50. And so, like, if anything, where I'm trying to, yeah, so I'm looking at it right now, like, it's not, you would be hard pressed to be like, oh, he writes books. He, like, even the calendar, we haven't done a calendar post in a while. And so, for me, I'm trying to be better about that. Like, just because I'm like anybody else. Like, I like the fun parts. The sales part is hard. Like, it's hard to do that. Like, it's not natural to me. And so, I'm trying to do a better job of going, I think part of being an entrepreneur is admitting that if you're not good at that, you don't get to be that very long. And so, I'm trying to get better at saying, what's the purpose of this? Like, if I do five different, you know, email lists right now, which has been really fun and it's been successful. But if I'm not selling something from them and I don't have them as part of a strategy, that's just wasted time. And eventually that doesn't end well.
So that was actually one of the next things I wanted to go into was just email, email strategy.
Yeah.
So it's the thing that doesn't get talked about, and yet to this day is probably one of the most effective ways to reach and connect. I mean, so how are you as an entrepreneur using email to connect with?
So people? 10 years ago, if I could go back 10 years and tell myself to do something business-wise, I'd say don't get lost in the sexy, shiny part of social media. Like, lean into the nerdy, dorky, but powerful part of email. Like, email all day. Like, I, you know... So I guess the big change for me was about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I realized it's really hard to communicate generally. It's easier to communicate specifically. So I had this general email list that I would send out ideas, and it was like every idea I either had to do a, like, maybe you're this person, maybe you're that person, like 17 examples to try to get you to connect to the content, or I just had to do this general vanilla idea that, like, helped nobody. So I said, okay, I want to segment you. I'm going to raise your hand if you're into writing. And then all the writers did. Raise your hand if you're into being an entrepreneur. And now I know I can nerd out on those topics, and I fulfilled the commitment. Like, I said, I'll send you writing ideas. So you should never complain and be like, oh, another writing idea on the thing that's called the writer's list. Like, yeah, that's what it is. Or like the writer's list today was, never say at the beginning of a book project, never ask yourself, will this sell? Like, you should ask it as you market it and as you work on it at the end. But at the beginning, that question will cripple you, and you'll hear, no, it won't. And then you'll create something that you don't even love because you're like, I got to manipulate it to sell the most copies. And now it's not even fun anymore. And so the other day, the speakers list was about stools, like reasons you shouldn't sit on a stool when you speak. Like, that's so specific and nerdy. But my open rate went from 20% on my general list to like 50 to 70% on my specific, which... Because, and so now I can serve that need, but also if I have a product like Finish that I know, here's how it helps people with fitness goals, I can write a very specific email about Finish and fitness and give that to someone who's into that.
So you segment, and then you write different emails or newsletters, you might say, that are geared toward those segments. What's the end game?
The end game that I'm working on. So right now, for the first time, like, again, I'm not organized. For the first time, I'm really coming up with a deliberate content plan so that I can say, I think part of where you get to, hopefully, is you say, when I create this, here's the 17 things that happen. Like, systems. It's all systems. Like, if an entrepreneur focused on the 10 things that weren't sexy, the business would last a lot longer than focusing on the 8 that are, you know? And so, or the things that feed your ego, but not your business. And so for me, I'm like, the end game is I'll create products off of the content because it's good content. I'll use some of the best pieces as blog posts. I'll use it to hopefully, you know, share the speaker's course with people. So, like, imagine if I spend X amount of time building up a 15,000 person email list of people who just are into public speaking, and I study them and understand them, and then I create a product that's for them. Like, I'll hopefully be able to sell them that product because I know what their needs are and I can actually serve them. So that's the long-term game. The short-term is just figuring out, okay, how do you, like, you're selling a calendar. Okay, we've got a calendar. Here's what we're going to do. And here's what it looks like. And then you kind of go from there.
Right. So I think another thing, because I've known you for a little while now, and I've definitely watched, you know, kind of what you've been up to for several years. And I remember you had this 30 days of hustle, yeah. and you might have even done something like a 90-day hustle or something like that. Yeah. I mean, like you tried a bunch of different things, and then you just talked about how you're now doing sort of like a speaker class and stuff. Would you say that those things have evolved? And if they have, you know, into what you want to do and what works and what doesn't, what would you say, what would be some sort of helpful thing for somebody who's listening who wants to do that type of program, just to give them sort of a tip?
Yeah, know? I think leaning into what you actually have authority in. There's different schools, and I'm not of the school. Some people will tell you, go on Google Trends, find out if people are searching for butterfly wings, create a webinar about butterfly wings and sell that webinar. Like, I don't, but if I'm not an expert at butterfly wings, like I don't create long-term customers because the product won't be won't be amazing. And so what I've tried to do is say, here's something that I'm passionate about and interested in and have some developing degree of expertise. Here's the thing I'm getting questions about. Like, so here's what I would say, like, to all the entrepreneurs listening, it's three circles. It's my curiosity, it's a need in the community, and it's the market. So my curiosity is, what's a question I'm really trying to answer? Like, for me, how do I finish things in my own life? The need. People came up to me and said, I've read Start, but how do I actually finish? And then I checked the market. The only thing that comes up if you type finish in Amazon was dishwasher detergent. And so I was like, all right, everybody talks about the start, but nobody talks about the finish. There's a need. Where I, you know, what I say to entrepreneurs is, if you have two of the three, it falls apart. So if you go, I got a huge passion, nobody's serving it in the market, but there's no need, that's a hobby. Like, you might love albino ferret ownership. Like,
nobody loves huge that. Passion. That's crazy. No way.
Yeah, but that, I mean, like, I've been the exotic pet expo here.
Okay, I'm sure it exists. I know everything times. Exists.
Yeah, I know, like, there's lemur communities, like sugar glider communities, where they sell shirts that have a pouch in the front with a zipper so you can sit there. But if there's only your passion plus nobody's serving in the market but nobody actually needs it, it's just a hobby. So I think a big part of it for me is going, I love public speaking. I've done it for 10 years. It's been a big part of my business. I've grown it. People ask me those questions all the time. Okay, how do I get a gig? How do I get confident? How do I use humor? And then I look in the market and there's not a million people doing it. Like, there's definitely some people doing great courses, but I'm going to do my version and share my expertise on that. I think those things, that's where I've evolved, like, is to try to really lean into. And because if somebody said to me, you could make $100,000 more just doing webinars and you'd never have to leave home, I think I would not do it.
Yeah, it's not your personality. You like the audience. You like to be there. Yeah.
That's such a, like, because people will say, like, people tell me all the time, public speaking isn't a good business because you have to be there to get the money. Like, it's not passive. And I think the being there is the best part, dummy. Like, that's what I love.
For you.
For me, yeah. But, like, tell a musician, right. You don't have to play live concerts ever again. You can just teach lessons to kids in Topeka online. Like, that's not the, unless you're into that, that's not your thing.
I think that's an excellent analogy. Yeah. I have one more question for you.
Yeah.
So aside from, I would, you know, we'll just say the advice to read your book, Finish. What advice?
They're already buying the calendar. I mean, because that.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the calendar. I forgot the calendar.
Yeah. Come on, dude. We got babies need shoes. You know where I live.
Aside from clicking the Amazon affiliate link, I'll leave.
Yeah.
That has this, and buying all of his books and the calendar. What advice do you have for those who are listening, who have been wanting to start that new business? That new thing, but they feel stuck or overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it doesn't have to be massive. Like, it really doesn't. I think a big part of this, that was one of the interesting things in Finish, was the research showed how important fun is, that it's got to be fun if you're actually going to do it, and you have to make it fun. It's not just have fun. And so the thing that you kind of look at is, am I reward-focused? Am I fear-focused? And fear, I don't mean in a bad way. I mean a consequence. So I think if you're stuck, it's completely okay to go, I need a little reward for this. Like, I need to know if I finish this thing, I get to go to a movie by myself. Or I need to know, you know, a consequence for me was announcing the comedy. and saying, okay, this, if I don't do this, like, that's real. Like, everybody I know and love in Nashville is coming to this. That's going to be really embarrassing if it sucks. You know, like, because I don't get to leave. If you do comedy in Sacramento and it bombs, you're like, adios, Sacramento. Like, I'm not coming back. If you do it in your backyard with neighbor, like, you live around the corner from me. Like, it, people at the pool would have had to be like, yes, good for you. Way to, like, you really did that thing. Like, they would have had to say vague things. And so I think if you're stuck, it's okay. Instead of, like, white-knuckling it, or instead of going, it's going to be this huge thing and I'm going to launch it, like, just go, what's one part of it? And then how do I kind of think about it like stacking the odds. How do I put it, so many motivational things around it that I actually want to do it?
And the reality is, you may have failed at that comedy thing. I mean, you knew you wouldn't, yeah. And you didn't, but I'm saying...
But there's things that do
it's
differently.
Okay, but it's okay... It's okay to, like, do it, put it out there, and fail, because if you're like me, if we're all like all of us here, we failed.
Yeah.
I failed for like 10 years straight in my entrepreneur world until I finally had a successful company.
Yeah.
And it's okay. I've failed on stage.
Yeah.
I thought that I'd put together the greatest presentation ever, and oh my goodness, I was embarrassed. I mean, but you know what? I went on. Who cares? I mean, it's just...
Well, that's part of it, is that I think, and that's a whole other conversation about the ascendancy myth, that it's always going to be bigger next year and that you're only going to rise. Like, that's not true. You know, like, if you're an author, every next book doesn't necessarily sell more than the last one. Like, if you're, you know, and so I think that's part of it too, is going... Because there's failure, like, it bombed, and I'll figure that out. But there's also, like, I got a C-, but I expected a AAA+, because I read a magazine that had the top, you know, 20 people under 20 that have amazing companies, you know? And you go, because you and I are now in our 40s, and I'm assuming you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, man.
There's no top 50 under 50 list. Like, once you're in your 40s, they just expect you to do stuff.
Right.
So, like... I just think you kind of go, all right, I'm going to try the thing. Like, if the thing fails, there's certain things that my parents told me that at the time I thought, oh, that's just like silly wisdom. But now, like, the trying your best, like, I knew that I had tried my best at the comedy thing. Like, and I, you know, in my head, I had crazy expectations of like, oh man, an elite does so many things that night. Like, somebody will call me and be like, this is amazing. Like, we love you. Like, you have all these crazy expectations, but I also felt really satisfied that I did the best. I really feel like I did the best I could have done. Now I look at it and go, I know I needed to change that, or I tweak this if I did it a third time or a fourth time. Like, but even if you fail, I think it still comes down to, like, did you try your hardest? Like, and you might be wrong. Like, that's the other thing. Your best might be wrong for that situation, and you go, oh, that was different than I thought. Like,
right.
I didn't. Or it might, like, I remember a client asked me to do three extra little mini speeches at an event when I showed up, and I wasn't mature enough to go, nah, I don't have anything prepared, it won't be good. I was so eager to please that I did the three things. They stunk. The client was unhappy with them. And so now I would go, I would love to, but here's the thing. Like, I have a really thing that I'm excited about. I'm going to say no to that.
But here's the thing is, you did it and you tried. So my attitude towards all of it is, the thing that matters the most is that you tried and that you did something. That is what kind of separates, I think, sort of creativity and greatness and progress and doing things that are meaningful that weren't there before, is that all of those things that all the people and the things and the companies that we may look up to and respect and be like, man, I can't even imagine a world without that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have happened if those people hadn't have failed a million times. And I personally do not, I would rather be a person with a ton of failures who tried than somebody who didn't do anything. That's like, that to me is pure misery, is to live a life doing nothing.
Yeah.
And never trying. I'm fine having 90% failure rate because I had fun doing it.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't fun when I was failing and falling on my face.
Yeah, but I think that's the last thing I'll say is, like, did you have fun? I mean, again, I don't like the cliche of, like, it's the journey, not the whatever, the destination. But I think there is part of it where Like, if I write a book and I have an amazing experience doing it and it doesn't make a ton of money, like, yeah, it's a failure in the sense of, like, I wish it had made more money. But, like, I had a pretty amazing year. And I came home happy to my wife. Like, my, like, that was a huge win that I wasn't a jerk. Like, versus if I write a type of book I'm not supposed to write, but I'm like, and Jenny has said that to me before. She's like, when you write certain books, you're a jerk during the book process and you're a jerk during the launch process. So we need to figure that out. And so, like, she would tell you, oh, yeah, this book that sold 40% less than the other one, but he was super happy for like 2 years. And that was pretty dope for us and the whole family. So
I think as we get older, we learn how much more important that is.
Yeah, yeah. And I and when you forget it is when you have to go learn it again. And that's painful.
Man, thanks for meeting with me.
Yeah, it was fun, dude.
Love the conversation.